The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, in recognition of Mother's Day, we'll learn how affectionate mothering impacts children as they grow up. It's graduation season, and students are showcasing their research and preparing for life after college. That new research provides a deeper look at what's underneath Yellowstone National Park. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Happy Mother's Day. The parenting style that mothers use has a great impact on their child's personality and traits that develop later in life, whether it be positive or negative. Our next guest studied affectionate mothering for its impact on children as they grow up. Madeline Reynolds spoke with Yasmin Virts, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, to learn more.
As a parent, you can't always be positive, and sometimes your children do things they are not meant to, and you have to discipline them. But even in that situation, that can be done in a caring and empathic way, for example, by expressing empathy for the child's position and trying to take the child's perspective.
Can you provide examples, I mean, real life, as to what affectionate mothering looks like, especially in childhood?
Yeah, so these could be things such as praising your child. So, for example, you know, you did a great job there, well done, showing interest in the child's thoughts and feelings, and also things such as using positive body language. So, for example, smiling, using a gentle tone in your voice, rather than shouting or screaming, for example.
So, in your research, it states that in early childhood, there are big five personality traits that can impact the personality traits that we later develop with affectionate mothering. So what are they, and can you explain them for us?
Yes, so the personality traits are typically measured when children are a bit older. So rather than in early childhood, these sort of character traits we see emerging more as children grow older. And in our particular study, we measured them at age 18. The traits that we measured are five key character traits that we know from previous research provide a good description of most people's personalities, because they refer to sort of major patterns in how people think and act. So, for example, how outgoing someone is, how organized they are, and also how emotionally stable they are.
So how did you conduct your study to see how affectionate mothering can impact the personality traits that we later develop in our life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is a long-term study. So the families in the study have participated ever since their children were born, and they have been followed up until the children were 18 years old. And so we measured the affectionate mothering when the children were young, when they were between 5 and 10 years old. And then we measured the children's personalities when they were age 18 years old. And what was interesting about the study in particular is that we used a twin sample. So all of these families are families where they are twin children. And so that is important because it meant that we were able to rule out a bunch of other influences that could potentially explain this link between parenting and personality. So we know that genetics is quite important in that link, but because we're looking at genetically identical twins, we were able to rule out that influence of genetics as well as of other influences that are shared between those twins growing up in the same family.
So how does affectionate mothering affect a child's behavior, for example, and vice versa? So what would that look like if they weren't experiencing that affectionate mothering?
Yeah, so we did not test mechanisms per se, but some of the pathways that we speculate about is that if a parent is more affectionate, this might teach children to be more supportive and warm and empathic themselves. And it is also the case that affectionate parenting might help children better regulate their emotions and behaviors, which could lead to them finding it easier to be more persistent and conscientious. And the other path that we're thinking of is that if a parent is affectionate, it might reduce children's fear of judgment and therefore encourage them to be more open and creative in their behaviors.
you point out that affectionate mothering is not the sole thing or experience that develops our personality and the traits that we do develop later on. So what other things contribute to the personality traits that we develop as time goes on? Can you give examples for us?
Yeah, so a very important factor are genetics. So it is the case that people's genetics do seem to have some influence on their personality. And that might also be part of the reason why personality traits sometimes run in families. Other experiences that people make as a child or as they grow older as well, such as the relationships they have, both when growing up as adults. So we know that a lot of personality development and change still happens when we're adults. So it's not finished once we enter adulthood. There are also broader influences such as cultural differences. For example, I lived in the US for a few years and I was struck by how there's generally a tendency there for people to be more extrovert compared to where I'm from or the UK where I live now. So these overall cultural differences could also play a role there.
In all, what benefits or the positive impacts does affectionate mothering have on us throughout our lives?
Yeah, so via these personality traits, which as I mentioned are so important for many life outcomes, we think that it could have a broad impact on our lives and our longer term outcomes. So including how well we do in education, in our jobs, how we get on with others, and our physical and mental health as well. So it does seem to be the potential there for quite widespread effects. Although I will also say that all the effects that we found were very small. So it doesn't mean that if someone did not experience that affectionate mothering, they are now doomed to do poorly in life. So absolutely would not say that based on our findings.
What can parenting programs do in terms of considering all the findings and research you have discovered to fully support parents and give them all the necessary tools, info, and support and practices to succeed?
Yeah, so a lot of parenting programs focus on increasing affectionate parenting. And of course, they do that using a variety of strategies. So you can't just tell a parent to be more affectionate. It's usually not that easy. But by modeling positive behaviors, for example, showing videos, doing role play, helping parents recognize their own emotions and situations that trigger stress for them or a negative response or frustration so that they're able to control those responses better. And coaching positive communication. So as I already mentioned, reminding parents to praise their children when they did a good job, showing interest, so actively asking the child, for example, what they have done during the day, how they're feeling, and using that positive language when speaking with the child.
And then finally, what are you looking forward to researching into the future regarding this topic?
Yeah, so we're actually just following up these twins into adulthood. This study is based on when they were 18 years old. They are now 30 years old. And so we would be really curious to see how these effects persist over time. So even into older adulthood, not old, but a bit more advanced. And we're also quite interested in looking at how these effects hold up across different cultural and international comparisons. So we're doing a study in Germany at the moment as well to see whether we see similar effects, because as I mentioned, both parenting and personality can vary a bit across cultures and sort of contexts. And so those are some of the ongoing projects.
Yasmin Virts is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Edinburgh. Her research into affectionate mothering is published in the journal American Psychologist. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. I'm Lucas Willard. It's graduation season, and as students prepare to leave college life behind, some say they aren't ready to enter the workforce. The best of our knowledge's Samantha Simmons spoke with students at two higher education institutions in upstate New York and has this report.
In the well of concrete known as the main fountain at the University at Albany, students study in the sun before taking a dip post-graduation. Jeremy Daly is hanging out with friends. Daly is a history major, but he doesn't plan on putting his degree to work, at least directly. He's going into the trades to be an electrician.
Well, it's kind of what I realized I wanted to do before college, but I still just wanted to go to college to, I guess, meet people.
Do you regret going to college and doing the money instead of just starting right out of high school in, like, a trade?
It's a question I've asked myself a lot. No, because I met good people.
Daly says he's excited to get his life started and spend time with his family and friends. Students like Daly are entering an uncertain job market. While statewide unemployment rates were down 0.1% in March from 4.3% to 4.2%, according to the New York State Department of Labor, many businesses and state agencies have paused hiring while awaiting clarity on the tariff wars. Across the river, students at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy are weighing their choices between entering the workforce or continuing on to a four-year school. Playing volleyball with classmates, Ryan Connors will be graduating this year. Connors, who plans to transfer to a four-year school, says he is not worried about finding a job. A business administration major, Connors says it can't be that hard.
You know, absolutely no fear. I don't think job security is a huge worry. I think even in today's society, if you don't have a job, there's still always ways to make money. You know, everyone has access to the internet here, and if you do, there's absolutely no excuses to not make money. You know, I'd really hope for a good job, but if not, the only thing stopping me besides that is laziness. So
around the corner, Tyler Hines is leaving class. Hines, a digital media major, has been doing freelance work and making connections to design websites, create logos, and more.
My family had connections, so I met with their connections, and those people work for the state, so kind of just solidified relationships with those people so I could rely on them when needed.
Some students, however, are pushing off the working world to pursue higher education. Claire Hart studies psychology and sociology at UAlbany. She says she hasn't done any internships or clinicals yet, but suggests undergrads do. Hart was accepted to grad school at UAlbany, but is deferring for a year. In the meantime, she'll be teaching in a job she got through a relative's husband.
Like, I feel like I've been lucky or taken everything kind of for granted, and maybe I'll get like a rude awakening. So I guess I am a little nervous.
Noah Simon is UAlbany's Director of Career and Professional Development. Simon has worked for the university for 18 years. He says getting a job this year is not any harder than past years for most students. Simon says college goes by quick, and some students are in denial when it's time to move on. He adds the department has seen an increase in first-year students using the service.
Some students are more eager to engage that process post-college, and others, and it's not going to change this year, it's not going to change next year, it's not going to change in the next 10 years. Students are going to be students, and some are going to put it off until they have to tackle it, and others are going to engage it earlier.
Simon says locally, cuts to federal funding in fields like environmental and social work haven't affected students' job search yet.
I think there is more awareness, certainly, of, you know, seeing some of the cuts that are happening in federal government and looking at opportunities, but that's something we always talk about. Too often, individuals in their job search get stuck in, I'm studying X, so I've got to go work in this field. And we need all job seekers and students, of course, to say, you know what, I'm studying, and you name it, it could be a psychology, it could be an accounting, it can be anything. You know, maybe I should look in other industries. And it's getting students to broaden their horizons.
Reporting for the best of our knowledge, I'm Samantha Simmons.
This is the best of our knowledge. Designs and devices filled part of the Western New England University campus as an engineering expo showcased the efforts of more than 300 students. WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief James Polyalagopoulos reports from Springfield, Massachusetts.
In the gymnasium, the 2025 Emerging Engineers Expo featured the work of seniors as well as first-time smart projects spanning engineering of all kinds, from biomedical to industrial to construction management and more. Mike Rust is a biomedical engineering professor and director of experiential and entrepreneurial learning in the College of Engineering.
Some of those are first-year engineering projects where they've got a clear customer, they've made a prototype, and they've got a marketing plan for what they're trying to bring to the marketplace. And then we've got about 60 or so senior capstones. So those are students at the end of their four-year journey with us, working for either a semester or the full year. Sometimes those projects come from industry, sometimes they're from the faculty research, or sometimes the students create those projects as well.
Altogether, there were 35 first-year innovation projects and 69 senior capstone design projects, according to the university. Displayed on an array of tables like a science fair is work ranging from an apparatus built to vent in dry, wet shoes to jet engine system designs. There was also work featuring the campus itself, like studies of renovation options for the university's Rivers Memorial Hall, which houses WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau. Plenty included devices assembled and already in action, like that of mechanical engineering senior Zachary Wisk, who designed and built a wall-mountable air purifier, capable of nabbing particulate matter while also using little power.
I wanted to make something wall-mounted, so you could mount it up high in a wall, turn it on, and then kind of just forget about it. So it just, every day, all day, it's just filtering air, ensuring that rooms have low particulate matter in them and are healthy. Because ever since COVID and wildfires happening recently, there's a lot of particulate matter being blown around.
It's also pretty quiet. The only way to hear it is to get your ear or microphone up close to the device, which is about the size of two or three stacked textbooks. Nearby, a trio of mechanical engineering students stand over a small, bolted-down cylinder with wires and a small screen sticking off to the side, an integrated cycle counting system, according to student Douglas McPhail. The team uses an air compressor to cycle the bolt of a hypothetical nail gun or firearm their counter could potentially go on. Brandon Pepin leads me through it.
And so every time it refills with air, you pull the trigger, it goes down, removes a round from your nail gun count, and then with a firearm, it'll demonstrate how many rounds are remaining in your magazine.
Following a cycle, a small screen attached to the apparatus ticks down from 0 to negative 1. McPhail.
So, you hold your new mag up to the RFID sensor, press the new mag button, and it will update your system. Unfortunately, it was already sitting at 0, but it will remember, if we go back to mag B, which is the default magazine internally, it will remember that there were no rounds inside of it.
Their colleague, Rafael Radueso, says similar devices are being developed elsewhere, but his team has been working on something more user-friendly.
Oftentimes they required proprietary technology that required their stuff to work with their systems. Ours is completely, you can bring your own to the party and it works. It's more user-friendly, it's more consumer-friendly, and it's better for the market, I think.
A few tables down, another trio of students, all biomedical engineering majors, stand over a special ultrasound device setup intended to make life easier for medical professionals. One of the students behind the Sonosite ultrasound probe heater is Noor Alkal.
Basically, we have a sponsor, Dr. Zachary Koopy from Yale New Haven Hospital. He came to us saying, hey, I do like 20 ultrasound-guided IV insertions in a shift. That's 25% of my shift just stabilizing ultrasound probe. My hand is killing me at the end of it. Could you come up with something to hold the ultrasound probe or just make my life easier with this? So from that, we took all of his feedback. He showed us how to do an ultrasound-guided IV, and we came up with our device.
The medical device consists of a clamp with a series of adjustable rods with an ultrasound machine wired around it, honed in on a fake arm fitted into holders below it, says fellow developer Matthew Darling. Darling says he's looking into grad school, but hopes to one day work in research and development, as well as cell and tissue engineering. Alkal says she's also interested in research, while their partner, Ashton Rakowski, says he's been job searching, hoping to work at medical device companies. There were similar stories across the gymnasium floor as professionals and experts surveyed the projects, giving valuable feedback and evaluations along the way. For Professor Rust, it's one of his favorite days of the year.
We have industry partners, local companies, alumni, even members of our campus community that are here as judges. And so they're going around and they're evaluating the projects, And a lot of that interaction, you just can't buy that time in front of somebody where they're going to ask you questions about what you've done. In some cases, it's like a job interview. And even if it's a first-year student, they're planting a flag with a company that might come back and look at them for an internship or a full-time employment downstream. The conversations are super rich. The students are talking about their ideas and how they've brought them to life over the past few months.
Reporting from Springfield, this is James Polyologopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. There are a lot of rumors about the volcanic activity under Yellowstone National Park, but new research shows that the park's magma reservoir is relatively stable. To learn more about what's underneath Yellowstone's famous geysers and mud pots, I spoke with Rice University researcher Chenglong Duan.
People in researchers' community, people have a long time debating like how deep it is, how deep the magma is stored in the subsurface of Yellowstone. So for decades, and we don't have a very clear image how the top of the magma it is. Many seismic researchers have done, they show the top of the magma ranges from 3 to 9 kilometers, which is a very wide range. So in our study, we are trying to use high resolution techniques. We use a vibro-size truck and create our own earthquakes and to study the top of the magma. And it works. And our study shows we got a very sharp top of the magma boundary at 3.8 kilometers. And with this shallow depths, we can infer, because it's shallow depths, it has the pressure and temperature can be different from the deep ones. So in this shallow depths, the volatile, the gas, can be exhaled from the magma body. So it can have pretty much volatiles in this kind of depths. And different from the deeper magmas with only rhyolite melt, it has a mixture of gas and magmas filled in the pore space of volcanic rocks. I think, yeah, that's a major finding we got in this paper.
So through this equipment, you were not only able to find where the magma is sitting beneath the surface, but you had also were able to determine exactly what's there. And in this case, there's a lot of gas that's trapped with the molten rock as well. And why is that so important to understand, that it's not just molten red hot magma down there, but there's also a lot of trapped gas and pressure as well?
Yeah, so just as I mentioned, in 3.8 kilometer depths, the gases can be dissolved from the magma. So like in deeper depths, you have a higher pressure, the gases will dissolve in the magma. It will not show us to a distinct phase. So in 3.8 kilometer depths with less pressure, less temperature, about temperature is still hundreds of degrees Celsius, it's still very hot. But in this phase, the fluid will have, the water will change its phase to liquid into liquid and the gas phases. So it's a mixture of both. So we call it supercritical fluid. But it will not cause very large explosive eruption, because the porosity is not that. So normally we think 30% porosity will cause large eruptions, but in our case we have only 14% porosity, rock porosity. So most of them are rock crystals. So and just 14% of the rock is filled with magma and the gas. So I think, and also with a very good channelized flow. So to the surface, the heat, the gas will have a very good dynamic system, balanced system. So it will not cause explosive erupt in this time of during this time. But this study does show that this kind of measurements to measure volatile accumulation can be a very direct indicator for us to measure the stability of the volcano, like whether it will have an explosive eruption in the future, do the amount of gas changes will cause instability. That's future research, but this research give us a hint that this kind of measurement can help us have a better knowledge on the volcanic system, such as Yellowstone.
And Chenglong, what will you be working on next in your research? Are you continuing to explore this method? Where would you like to go next in your studies?
Yeah, so in my case, I think during my postdoc, I start to study volcanoes, and I do seismological research based on the cutting edge methods, but it's a great place that I can apply these advanced methods to study volcanoes. Yellowstone is my first volcano I studied, but in the future, I think I will keep researching other volcanoes. And Yellowstone is one of it, absolutely. And the others, like Cascadia volcanoes, also the other very hot topic, like Iceland volcanoes or some small volcanoes. I think people are caring about if it will cause big eruptions. I think this knowledge, these techniques can be applied to give us a better picture of how the volcano is being changed during time. So yeah, in the future, I will still doing such studies, and hopefully some good research will come out in the next year.
Wonderful. I look forward to it. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Chenglong Duan co-led research into the magma beneath Yellowstone National Park. It's published in the journal Nature. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1805. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.